Hello, I'm Jonathan Hollow and welcome back to Second Lives. In this series, I've been discussing money, life and meaning with a series of guests who are either experts on these topics or who have struck out in midlife to make a radical change. Today, I'm talking to our final guest in the series, who's a bit of both. I'll be talking to Simon Bullock, founder of Mulberry Bow, the chartered financial planning boutique in the City of London that has generously supported this series throughout. Simon and I will be looking back at his favourite guest from the series, playing the extracts that really caught his ear, and talking about his own midlife change to set up Mulberry Bow and later moving to France. You'll hear about his own lessons in life changes, money management, and finding satisfaction in community. Mulberry Bow resonated with Robin Powell, the producer of this series, and myself when we were looking for a suitable partnership. Our book, How to Fund the Life You Want, set out a manifesto for evidence-based investing and putting life planning before money goals. As you'll hear, that's the approach that has made Mulberry Bow a successful business with very loyal clients. So now to Simon Bullock. Simon, tell us about Mulberry Bow and your role in it.
Sure, absolutely, Jonathan. So Mulberry Bow is a privately owned boutique firm, a chartered financial planning practice in the City of London that I established about 9 years ago. And effectively, a sort of throwaway line is that we help smart people avoid doing dumb things with their money. We cap our client numbers at 50 per advisor, which is quite unusual in the industry. I haven't really seen it anywhere else. I think that the average is somewhere probably around 250 clients per advisor, something like that, across the UK sort of wealth management industry. And we just felt that at those numbers, you tend to be quite reactive and it can become quite a transactional conversation, whereas we wanted to do what we would call sort of proper financial planning, really understand, you know, clients' sort of tax planning and financial sort of objectives and pensions and estate plan and all of that in some detail. And of course, that takes time.
One of the things that Robin Powell and I were impressed by when we started collaborating with Mulberry Bow on the series was our sense of the values behind you and the business. And I'm curious as to whether you've had kind of, you know, brainstorming sessions to document these values or whether they more arise from your personality and who you choose to recruit.
Yeah, it's a good question. Probably a bit of both, I think. We definitely have involved the whole team in that, and we have got a document that's called sort of What Makes Mulberry Bow Different, that is sort of mainly now an internal document, but it's a good reminder for us of sort of what we're not. You know, I think in many ways, like a lot of businesses that start up, as we did sort of coming up to 10 years ago, you know, you look at what else is out there in terms of financial advisors. And there's obviously just some very good ones, but our feeling was that there was, you know, there were some issues, if you like, some a lack of alignment of interest. I think that we reacted a little bit to that, but then I also think we've put our own sort of, if like, positive personality into it. I think it was Steve Jobs I was reading, and Steve Wozniak, when they started Apple, they sort of said they designed devices that they themselves want to use. And we very much designed a financial planning firm that we would want to use.
Well, let's listen to a few of the extracts that you picked out and found particularly meaningful. Andrew Hallam was one of my favourite guests. That was episode 41. I would describe Andrew as a writer and teacher about life, giving and happiness. You set out in your book some evidence about what I would call the shape of happiness that people typically experience in their lives, with particular respect to their 20s and then their maybe late 40s or early 50s. Can you just talk about that general shape that you found out about?
Yes, it's U-shaped. And so by that, what I mean is when you are in your early 20s, the world is your oyster. Generally, when we look at global surveys on overall life satisfaction, it's very high. It's very high for most of us in our early 20s. But what happens is expectations start being put on our shoulders. Some of those expectations are genuine. You know, we need shelter. We need a place to live. We need to get a job. But coupled with those genuine expectations are the smoke and mirror expectations that we just perceive, but don't really exist. So they are the keeping up with the Joneses expectations. If I don't get this job, what will people think of me? You know, or if I pursue this kind of job, I can have some sort of status within my neighborhood. If I buy this kind of house, if I buy this kind of car. And it's interesting, Jonathan, because what that ends up doing is it actually ends up dragging us down based on life satisfaction surveys. The you drops into our 30s, into our 40s. It's at that point where we are basically living a life for other people without realizing it. And what the research suggests is that in most cases, once we get into our early 50s, the Joneses do not matter.
So I've got to ask, Simon, how's that been for you?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I remember thinking when I first listened to it, and it's really interesting hearing it again, that my personal journey was that I could compress U-shape. So I went through those phases he talked about pretty much from 20 to 30, and I was kind of out the other side. When I was 20, that idea of living for other people really resonates. But that hit home for me when I was about 28. It's quite funny, actually, because I got sent to sort of a career advisor or a career counselor by the company I was working for. And you get two free sessions. I ended up paying for a further sort of 102 sessions because I saw that lady every week for 2 years. And we went on from talking about career to talking about, life, the universe and everything, as Douglas Adams might say. And it was just incredible. And what I realized was exactly what Andrew's talking about there, which is I was living for other people. I was living for what I perceived, my family wanted of me or friends wanted of me, not obviously realizing that. And another way that the lady that helped me talked about it was I was sort of living with my head and not my heart. And when I came out the other side of that, I shaved my head, I quit my job, and I went traveling around the world for a year. And I ended my long-term 8-year relationship as well, which was not a bad relationship at all. But I realized that it was someone that I was best friends with and I loved, but wasn't the person that I was sort of meant to be with. So amicable parting, thankfully, and off I went. And I sort of never looked back. And there's definitely been some tough years since. And I think that the first kind of year of after I set the business up was probably stands out as a really tough year. But other than that, I've been very fortunate. Pretty much from 30 through to being 48 now, I've been up the other side of the U shape. As he rightly says, I think as you get older, you get a better sense broadly of what you want to do with your time and what's important to you, and you care less and less about what others think. Although to a certain extent, when you set up a business, and as some of your guests have spoken about, you can't think about what other people think. You never do it. You have to have sort of no shame in a way, or no fear of shame, and just go for it. Because if you really thought it through, you'd never do it.
You're listening to Jonathan Hollow, and this is Second Lives. I'm looking back with Simon Bullock over the themes of this series and exploring the changes Simon's made in his own midlife.
And you've also made a transition to a life in France as well, haven't you, recently? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that when I was listening to your other guest on my Second Lives, I suppose that's what jumped into my head was, A, going from a kind of corporate career into sort of running my own business was felt like a second life, felt very, very different. But then about 2 years ago, I sort of having got that kind of up and running, it one of the great privileges that came with it was an ability to shape how I wanted to work. And what I realized is that, we've in conjunction with my wife, is we wanted to raise our children in France. So when the children were still relatively young, around 5, we relocated to France. I still very much have a flat in London or near London on the Elizabeth line, and I spend more than half of my time here. Unfortunately, because you get an awful lot of school holidays in France, the family's with me at least half the time of that as well. So probably about 1 week a month I'm here on my own. I just completely focus on work. So that's probably the one downside, is I'm away from my family for that 1 week a month. But I don't work when I'm in France, but I obviously do a lot of thinking and planning and so on in my mind. And then when I'm in London, it's quite intense. I sort of effectively cram a lot in. And I know one of the things that you talked to one of your guests about was the 4-day week. So for, in many ways, I'm an example of someone who's doing something a bit like that, but probably to a slightly more extreme.
Did you specifically wish your children to grow up bilingual and it in a way, in a more cosmopolitan?
Yeah, I definitely saw that as a nice side effect of it, if that's the right way of putting it. I mean, they're sort of trilingual because whenever my wife's alone with them, she switches to Polish. So they're going to end up with three languages, and I guess that would make learning, you know, if they so wish, a fourth language, you know, a lot easier than certainly I would found learning a language. So I like that. I mean, we both love to travel. We're a mixed family in terms of nationality. I'm even a quarter Welsh, so we've got a bit of Welsh in there as well. So, you know, I think that's sort of how we see the world. And I noticed, you know, spending holidays in France and so on, that, and Spain and Italy, actually, that it just seemed to be a lot more relaxed. And also across the generations, you know, you go into a restaurant and there's sort of grandma at one end of the table with a glass of wine and a nice meal. And then, you know, there's a kid asleep in the corner and, you know, and all the different generations are kind of hanging out together. And I really like that. I'm not saying you don't see that in the UK, but it's maybe a little bit common.
You also asked to hear again from Scott Morehouse, who is, of course, a colleague of yours, but also a former Paralympian athlete. And in episode 49, he talked about his work with an organization called Amputees in Action.
I worked for a while with a firm called Amputees in Action, and effectively they did casualty simulation work with the military. And, you know, it sort of serves a few purposes, really, I suppose. Firstly, yeah, the sort of serious aspect of training for the military and trying to make it more realistic. You know, I think previously what would happen is, you know, they'd choose someone in the squadron, platoon, whatever that day, and they were going to be the injured party. And, you know, you'd write on their forehead, your arms blown off or your legs blown off, and, you know, it wouldn't be very realistic. And so the whole point of this was that the first time that some of the soldiers might experience somebody with an amputation and how to maneuver those people, you know, in a pretty threatening environment, you know, wasn't the first time that they come across it. So, you know, effectively we would get made to, you know, made up with special makeup and, you know, look like we'd been blown up, and we'd get placed in certain, you know, certain scenarios where, you know, we'd get a cue. It would be, you know, the big 50 cal going off, and that would be our cue to come out and, you know, scream and shout and pretend that we'd just been injured.
That is a pretty extraordinary way of giving something from yourself to other people. I mean, what did this make you reflect on, Simon?
I looked for a long time for something that, you know, really resonated with me in terms of giving back. Like, you know, my wife and I, we tithe. It's a religious term, really, that means giving 10% of your income. That, you know, it's still fairly popular for some people. For me, it was the simplicity of it. I felt like I needed something that is so difficult, isn't it? Because you could always, certainly those of us that are lucky enough to live in the West and have a sort of any kind of professional job, you know, we're all very well off, aren't we, in sort of global terms and certainly historical terms as well. And I think that, you know, where do you draw the line in terms of what you could give up in order to give more back? And there's obviously always another thing that you could do without. And I was sort of trying to look for something that was simple, something that, and I think, well, you know, my wife felt the same, something that we could just stick to and commit to. We'd already decided that apart from giving our children a reasonable sort of start in life, that we would leave everything at the end of our lives to good causes. So we'd already made that decision, and we were sort of thinking that during our life, you know, what do we feel kind of okay with? And for some reason, just 10% on top of obviously paying all of our sort of taxes and so on, it felt like that was a reasonable amount to sort of give back. And so far, it's worked pretty well for us.
So Spotlight, which you've mentioned to me once or twice before, which I've seen, and for those who may not have seen it, it's a story of journalists exposing sexual abuse in the Catholic Church in Boston, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
That obviously made a big impact on you. I mean, tell me more about that.
Well, partly I looked at it, I mean, it might sound terrible, but and partly I looked at it as a business owner in terms of sort of the return on expenditure. I thought, I mean, the human side of it's incredible. And then I sort of found myself thinking about, you know, this hasn't cost that much money. These people are working on a shoestring budget, incredibly brave and hardworking and highly motivated, these journalists. And they're taking on, you know, a massive global organization with huge influence and resources and wealth and standing in the communities. And it's particularly in Boston, you know, the Catholic Church at the time that this investigation was happening, in a lot of those communities, it was just completely untouchable. The local priest, you know, was kind of God's representative on earth as far as a lot of the worshippers considered it. And these, yeah, so I just looked at it and thought, for what that's actually cost in time and money, the impact is immeasurable. And how many kids have they saved, you know, in the future from being exposed to some of the behavior that's going on?
I didn't expect you to come up with that perspective on it. And it was that line of thought that led you to giving to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism.
It was exactly that. And it was also some of the stuff I've been reading about evidence-based philanthropy and effective altruism and so on. And I know that, you know, that's sometimes had a mixed press, but I think the fundamental principle is really sound, that there's absolutely nothing wrong with applying some of the principles of good business to giving.
This is Second Lives with Jonathan Hollow. This is the final episode in a series of 12, which has been made with the help of Mulberry Bow, the chartered financial planning boutique in the City of London. Its founder, Simon Bullock, has been involved with the design of the series and helped us to find some of our great guests. So we're taking a look back at it together. So this is from episode 47. It's with Rosina Breen, who I would describe as a leader of investigative journalism. It sounds like, from what you say, that your mum always wanted to encourage aspiration and presumably independence if she was keen on you going away to India on your own for a year. Is that right? That she would have seen this as a natural path for you?
I think she was highly nervous of me going to India on my own, but I, you know, at age 18, 19, it's, you know, those are difficult conversations, aren't they? And I would say that she was never specific about what she wanted me to do. And I feel the privilege of that, really. She didn't try and drive me down certain career pathways. She was very open to the arts, which I think was quite unusual, perhaps, from a sort of community point of view, and ultimately wanted, I have a brother and sister, ultimately wanted us to feel fulfilled and happy, also to be able to pay our own way. You know, she always encouraged us to try our best and to feel fulfilled and to achieve our potential wherever that may lie. So I felt very emboldened by her. There is no point feeling or being safe. If you want to achieve, you have to have a stretch in order to grow.
This obviously touched a nerve in you in a positive way, I think, Simon.
Yeah. It did, Jonathan. I think the bravery, obviously, to go to India at 18 is pretty incredible. Although, of course, Rosina had a very interesting childhood, so maybe she was a little bit more prepared for that, having lived in different countries already. But it did make me think, my first wife actually spent a year in Nepal when she was same age, teaching in a little village school and living with the headmaster's family and so on. And I remember her saying how that, you know, set her up to sort of, you know, almost any future challenge in her life, she felt she could take it on, having, you know, survived that and thrived in that environment. And much less impressively, I do think back to the three French exchanges I went on as a teenager. I think the first one was only 12 or 13, and it was quite daunting, you know, living in a family of strangers who spoke a different language that I was supposed to be able to speak, but I wasn't necessarily the best student when it came to French. Even at 12, 13, your sort of personal sort of hygiene and all getting organized with your clothing and all that sort of stuff that, you know, you take for granted when you're older, but even for a week, 10 days is pretty challenging. And I think, you know, those sort of experiences when you're younger, not just with money, but all aspects of sort of managing, you know, managing your life, really do set you up. And I thought that Rosina's experience was pretty incredible.
Well, let's turn to John Trahan. This was from episode 46. He's the Gym Group founder and definitely would be described as a serial entrepreneur. This is him on the sense of risk-taking.
You created and then sold a chain of health clubs in the decade up to 2001. And then in 2007, I believe you were in your early 50s, you set up the first location of the gym group. And so you built two major businesses from scratch. I'm really interested in what was going through your mind as you set off the second time around.
Here we go again. I mean, to be honest, the low-cost gym sector was very different. And I suppose that's what particularly excited me by it, that it wasn't just replicating what I'd done before. I suppose the other big spur for me was everybody told me it wouldn't work. Nobody wanted to use a gym 24 hours a day. Nobody would, you couldn't make any money only charging £10 a month. And nobody would want to join online. Well, 800,000 members later, I can tell you that they were completely wrong.
Did you see a connection with your own risk-taking there, Simon?
I did, Jonathan. I mean, John's, as he was very kind enough to sort of talk about in his interview, he's a long-standing client of Morbury Bow, and you know, very fortunate to call John and his family, sort of they've become friends as well of myself and my family, and he is an inspiration for me, to be honest. I obviously didn't know him when I set up Morbury Bow, but as I got to know him, you know, and I'm absolutely very proud of what I've helped to build with Morbury Bow, you know, with the team and so on. But, you know, what John achieved, it was just quite incredible to go to from one gym to, I think, sort of 350 gyms. It's just an incredible achievement. And as he rightly said, he helped remake an industry, really, because, you know, before that, I mean, I remember being a member of another sort of gym chain and paying sort of over £100. And I'm going back sort of 20 years, you know, and for these guys to come in and make gym membership so much more affordable. You know, I'm a member, I go regularly, and, you know, I'm in a fortunate position now where I could afford a more expensive gym, but to be honest, I don't really want one or need one. I think that John's achievement is incredible. And of course, like several of your guests, he's, you know, he's achieved obviously in a different field before that as well, in terms of being a top flight elite squash player. So I think there's again an inspiration there that whatever you achieve, you know, you can always take on another challenge.
Let's now go to Hector Garcia, who is a writer and I would say an investigator of contemporary Japan. He was in episode 45, and it was certainly one of my favourite interviews. Does the Japanese language actually have a word for retirement?
Yeah, it has many words for retirement, but when you get into the nuance of what it really means, it's like, it feels, once you learn Japanese, it feels to me that the meaning is not really, is not as negative as the word retirement. So in Japanese, when you use the words retirement, it's more like you are transitioning to another phase in your life, in which maybe you were doing something, you were focused on a daily job, and now you're going to be focused in your family. Or maybe you're going to be focused in a more relaxed work, like daily work. Like in Japan, you can work even after you are 65 or 70. You can work 20 hours per week, and it's perfectly legal. You can keep making money if you want. But most people, they retire in the sense that they stop working for a company, but they keep doing other things. You can focus on mainly like focusing on your hobbies. You become an artist, or you focus on your family, on your community, things like that. So the mindset is different. You are moving to another phase of your life. For me, the word retirement in English, it feels like you are being, like you are not going to be useful anymore to anyone. You are retired. It's like you are also, you use the word also for other things. When you retire, like an old furniture, you don't need it anymore. You are going to throw it away.
So you're an expert on retirement planning. What did this extract from Hector's interview make you think about, Simon?
Yeah, I certainly would agree with him. I think, you know, retirement for me has become a bit of an outmoded word. We do still sometimes talk about it. Sometimes it's a helpful sort of shorthand, I suppose. But more and more we talk about wanting to get into a position where you only work you know, if you want, how you want, on what you want, when you want. You know, our clients want control over their time and flexibility much more than they want to retire, you know, in the traditional sense. And I think what's interesting, just observing, you know, with my own family, some of the clients I've worked with, generally, retirement's not necessarily good for you. You know, even at 70, I think properly sort of retiring in the sense of I'm just going to kind of play golf or whatever, you know, whatever people sort of imagine doing, it's not necessarily good for you. You know, I think if you can keep your hand in, even this week, funny enough, I've just met a new client for the first time that we're probably going to be working with. And she was talking about her mother retired in a traditional sense and sort of did nothing but leisure, and actually is now got back involved with sort of a charity and is going to be a trustee, and realized that she needed, you know, even in her mid-70s, she needed to keep her hand into something and have a bit more sort of structure and purpose or whatever. And that certainly fits with me.
You're listening to Jonathan Hollow, and this is Second Lives. Over the course of this series, we've explored lessons in life and meaning from all over the world. I'm looking back over them with the founder of Mulberry Bow, Simon Bullock. I'd like to play you a clip that your colleague, from my interview with your colleague Scott Morehouse, he was drawing a distinction between what you can achieve with financial planning versus what you can achieve with investment management. I'd just be interested in your perspective on that. So let me play the clip now.
With financial planning, there's a lot more tools that you've got in the kit bag to be able to help clients with. Unfortunately, with investing, nobody's figured out how to predict the future. And so you have very bright individuals working on something that come up with very seductive, very well thought out ideas, but fundamentally they can still be wrong. And that always bothered me. And actually, I like the fact that with financial planning, you could, obviously part of it is the investment strategy, but a big part of it is things that are very firmly within your control, that if you do these things, then yeah, they'll lead to good outcomes, and you can quantify some of those things.
How do you feel about the distinction that Scott draws between planning and investing in relation to what you can predict and control?
I think there's a lot to that, actually. And it's funny because we work with some very good investment management firms, but I think sometimes they can widen us, they're a little bit jealous, because it's quite tangible, isn't it? If you can show someone a clear financial plan, they can immediately, I think, see that it's going to save them time, hopefully give them a bit more peace of mind. You can show them, you know, pretty clearly that they're going to probably, you know, reduce the leakage, if you like, in terms of tax. You know, our clients are quite happy to pay tax, but they obviously, you know, there's nothing wrong with sort of structuring things in a sensible fashion to not pay more tax than you really need to pay. So they can maybe, you know, support their family a bit more or give more to good causes and so on. So that's all very kind of quite tangible. You can really sort of show it. And certainly within a year or two, our clients hopefully see the impact of our advice. Whereas an investment manager, it can be really difficult, right? It can take time to really show the value of giving investment advice. You know, for some of our clients, we give investment advice. For some of the other clients, particularly the larger clients, we're often working alongside other investment managers collaboratively. And yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. And I think sometimes, you know, on the investment side, the market can go up, you can kind of get the credit for the market going up when really it's just sort of the tide raises all boats. And equally, when times are tough, an investment manager will be doing actually quite a good job, but client can get quite frustrated if they've sort of lost money. Whereas, you know, I think financial planning, you can point at it, if you like, and demonstrate it maybe a little bit more easily.
Yes, I mean, one of the big problems with investment management is where do you put the counterfactual?
Yes, exactly. No, exactly that, Jonathan. It's really tricky. I mean, we've done some estate planning recently for clients where, because of a combination of inheritance tax relief and capital gains tax relief and income tax relief, they were getting tax relief of around 80%. Now, you know, we don't know exactly what the investment return will be within the vehicle that money's going to sit, but they're going to be 80% up effectively on day one from a tax perspective.
And you obviously feel quite strongly about transparency in the financial services industry. But for people listening that may not understand the nature of the issue there, I mean, how would you describe the problem, and how would you describe your own and Mulberry Bow's response to it?
I think one of the issues is that you've got an asymmetry of information, you know, and I think it's interesting if you look at it, it's definitely reducing. I think in investing used to be one of those areas a little bit like cars where, you know, you sort of walk in a car or a showroom and, you know, you don't really know how much a car should cost. Of course, you know, the advent of the internet and comparison websites and everything, both buying a car and I think to some extent investing your money has become democratized, and there's a lot more information now available to all of us if we want, you know, if we want to look for it. I think the difficulty with financial planning and tax structuring and estate planning is you're going into another level of complexity. So I'm not suggesting people shouldn't get advice on investing. I think many of us should. A lot of that is to do with behavior, if we're honest. I've got a financial advisor. I think we're all our kind of worst sort of guide, as it were, when it comes to our own money. But you've also got this issue that when you start thinking about estate planning and tax structuring and things like that, there is another level of complexity that you kind of go to.
So finally, as Mulberry Bow has been so critical to the development of this series, Simon, I'd like to offer you the last word.
That's very kind. There's a lot of pressure there from Jonathan. But yeah, I mean, I think it's been a great series. I think you've done a terrific job. And I think you've spoken to some really interesting people. And there's such a variety of different stories as well that those people have shared, which is one of the aspects I've really enjoyed. You know, I often think about a sort of a Venn diagram of sort of what's important on one side and sort of your relationship with money on the other, because obviously it's something that we do for a day job, and it's really where those two things overlap, you know, where your money kind of comes into alignment with what's important to you, that sort of, that's for me, that's a really sort of enjoyable bit of what I do. And I think there's been a number of examples in the people you've spoken to where absolutely there's obviously a money element to it, but it's also been about what was really important to them and how did they kind of bring those two things into alignment, because it's not straightforward, and it's such a personal thing, right? Everyone has a slightly different view of what's going to really work for them. So no, I think it's been an excellent series, and we've really enjoyed playing a small part in making it happen.